Awesome. Isn't that cool? It's always fun. It's always fun to look back and see what God's been doing. And if you're just kind of joining in, let me fill you in. Today is, we're celebrating our eighth birthday as a church. So happy birthday, church. We're now 8 years old. And it's so funny, in a church and in an organization, a lot of times it takes on the life of the age of a child, you know. In the first couple years, you're learning kind of how to walk and what to do. And you start to develop year in and year out. And it's been so fun to see what God has been up to, not just over these 8 years, but even in this past year. And those are a few scenes and reminders of some things that God has been doing in the life of our church. But I recognize, too, that it's not just about what God has done in the church collectively, but for many of us, we can say it's what God has been doing in our lives. We remember what God has been doing in our own lives, in our own families. And so, you know, one of our core values here as a church is that we will constantly celebrate what God is doing. We will constantly celebrate what God is doing. Why? So we just think it's a big deal to celebrate because we never want to take God's movement in our lives and God's movement in our church for granted. When God moves, it is always a big deal. I also want you to know, as we stand here now 8 years old as a church, actually technically with the fountain planted, we planted the fountain. The very first Sunday was March 4th, 2012. So we still got 3 more days, so it's a week of celebration, you could say. But I want you to know this, is that it really is a special thing to be part of a newer church, to be part of a newer church. And I've said this before, but it's really interesting because every church that you've ever been to had a starting point, and every church had a first generation. I grew up in a church that had been around for like 100 years, and I never really thought about the people that helped to make it possible from the beginning. And I just want to say to you, you are the first generation. You're the first generation of what God is building here, and it's a special thing that we get to be a part of laying a foundation for something that's going to be impacting lives for generations to come. And so what a cool thing. But I was reading over Psalm 115, and I think it captures the heart of this day in a lot of ways. Here's what it says, Psalm 115, verse 1. It says, "Not to us, Lord, not to us, but to your name be the glory, because of your love and faithfulness." And so from the very beginning of the fountain, and even as we celebrate our birthday today, it's never been about us. This is not a day where we say, "Way to go, church, like we're doing so good on some things." And, you know, it's never been about us. It's always been about Jesus. It's always been about connecting more and more people to Jesus' love. And we've seen story after story after story of people's lives that are being impacted in so many different ways. And so some of you know that the fountain, that we started the fountain from scratch with just two people and a big dream or vision from God. And we knew it was a God vision because we knew we couldn't accomplish it if God didn't show up and if God didn't come through. We moved into our house, and it was very uneventful because nobody cared, right? A lot of times when you go to a church for the first time, it's like, "Oh, this is my pastor, and these are our people," and we didn't have people. We didn't even have a name, right? It was very uneventful. But I remember the first time I was so excited in one of our preview services that I was going to get to say, "Welcome to the fountain." And I was thinking, this is going to be the first time that anybody's ever said that in a corporate worship in our church. And I was so excited. I had this picture of everybody just exploding with joy, right? And so I got up on it wasn't even a stage. It was like this, it was really rinky-dink place that we had a first preview service at Sharon Springs Elementary. But anyway, I stood up in front of everybody and said, "Welcome to the fountain." And a revival didn't break out right then, right? It just kind of was like flatline, right? It wasn't bad and it wasn't good. Usually when you say "welcome to da-da-da church," right? It's one of those things where people look and they say, "That's my pastor, this is my church, my life has been impacted here." But I realized in that moment, wow, we have no history. This means nothing to anybody. But I remember getting in the car and talking to Mandy about it, and I said, "But someday it will. Someday it will." And it's been so fun to see what God has been building. We started with a vision to reach and to connect people with the love of Jesus. That's always been to reach and connect people with the love of Jesus. And we say it like this: leading people to life hope, purpose, and wholeness through Jesus Christ. That's what we want to do in everything that we do. And so before we jump into our new series, we're going to get there. I wanted to share really a word on our birthday that I believe God put in my heart to share with us about our vision and where we're going in the future. And it's really two things. I want to encourage you by this. As the church continues to grow, here's the first thing I want to encourage you by. I want to encourage you, let's never lose our passion and pursuit for reaching new people for Jesus. Let's never lose our passion for people. Let's never lose our pursuit for reaching new people for Jesus, because that's why the fountain started in the first place. We started the church and because of that, and it always has to be our heart. Let's not lose our passion and pursuit for reaching new people. I say that because there is a gravitational pull. Do you feel it? There's a gravitational pull in every church. To over time, as things start going along, every church has this gravitational pull that starts to suck you towards being insider-focused, right? This gravitational pull, this magnetic pull that starts to make churches and people drift inwardly, where we start to say, well, it's about us and our preferences and what we want, and we stop looking at the outside of what Jesus is wanting to do beyond us. And so I'm begging you, let's fight against that tension. I'm begging you, don't ever be that person that says, well, don't you think that we've done enough, right? Let's not ever be that person that says, isn't our church big enough? Don't you think that our church is big enough, right? I like it the size that we are, whatever stage that we're at. And I wanted to say the fountain didn't start to be a certain size. Here's the thing. The truth is we're seeking to reach as many people as possible for as long as God will allow us. That is the mission. And so is the church too big? No way. We're always going to be reaching people because we have a mission. Amen? We have a mission. The mission is this, is we're trying to populate heaven. We're trying to populate heaven with people. We're trying to impact lives, not us doing it, but God through us doing it. We're trying to change people's life both now, forever, for the better, both now and for eternity. And so we always have to guard against that mindset that pulls us to say, this is about us. Let's guard against that tension. Let's keep our passion and pursuit for reaching new people for Jesus. Here, one of our core values as a church is that we will do whatever it takes, short of sin, to reach people far from God. Let's say that together. We will do whatever it takes, short of sin, to reach people far from God. Whatever it takes. Now, we're not going to do something that crosses the line into sin, but everything else is fair game, right? We're going to do everything that it takes to connect and to grow people in Jesus, whatever it takes. It's because as long as there's one lost person, as long as there's one broken marriage, as long as there's one teenager who is trying to find themselves and looking for purpose, as long as there's one more person who's looking for the abundant life of Jesus, we're never going to stop searching for lost people, because Jesus never stops searching for us. He never stops searching for you and for me. In fact, I was looking over Luke chapter 15. It's the story of the prodigal son and lost things. And he talks about lost sheep. And I was reading Jesus' words, and I was just astounded what Jesus said he's willing to do to reach people. Jesus basically says, I will leave the 99 who are found in order to go find the one who's lost. Like, he'll leave the 99 who are safely in the pen in order to go find the one, to impact the one who's lost. And what that means for us is Jesus isn't just hanging around a church building. It means that Jesus isn't just in a circle in our refresh groups. He is, but he's not just hanging out there. What it means is that during the week and all the time, Jesus is on the move. He's searching. He's wanting to impact people's lives. And so if we want to stay close to Jesus, what it means is we need to join Jesus in his search party. We need to join Jesus in his search party. And I'm telling you, as long as I'm the pastor here, we're always going to be part of that. We're always going to be a part of that. And I'm asking you to never get tired of it. Like, we're always going to keep reaching people and serving people and building things and building people. We're going to always seek to create services that will be a blessing to you who have been here for years and years and who maybe have a relationship with Jesus. And we're at the same time creating services that will communicate in a clear and compelling way to people who feel like they are so far away from God that God's grace could never work in them. It's for all of us. So let's never get tired of that. Here's what Jesus said to his followers in Mark chapter 16, verse 15. I love this. Jesus said to his followers, and I think he says to us, he says, go everywhere in the world and tell the good news to everyone. Everywhere to everyone. Everywhere to everyone. He wants us to go everywhere to everyone telling about Jesus. The second thing I want to encourage you to do, number two, is I want to encourage you, I'm asking you, will you be part of that search party? I'm asking you, will you be part of that search party? That's where we're going as a church. That's where we've always been going as a church. Will you be part of that search party? Don't leave it up to your church or the organization, but go everywhere to everyone. Invite people in. Bring people to church with you. We think Jesus is doing something here. We want people to be part of it. You know, Easter is coming up in 6 weeks. Did you know that? Some of you are like, I got to get my Easter dress, and guys are like, I don't have a dress, so I'm just going to wait till Easter, right? But Easter is in 6 weeks, and it is an incredible opportunity. It's a great opportunity to bring somebody with you. And so here's what I want you to be thinking about. If we're all part of the search party, here's what I want to encourage you by. Who in your life, who in your sphere of influence can you invite over these next 6 weeks? Who can you be inviting to bring with you, not just on Easter, but maybe even before that? Because we believe God's doing something and can do something in our lives. So let's bring people here. Today is also the first Sunday in the season of Lent. And it's funny, we were talking about Lent as a worship team before the service, and somebody kind of looked at their belly button. I was like, no, not that kind of Lent, right? The season of Lent is, if you're not familiar with it, is a season in the church where it's basically 40 days leading up to Easter. It's designed to be a time of spiritual preparation. And technically, it starts on Ash Wednesday, which was this past Wednesday, and goes all the way to basically Easter Sunday. And it's 40 days, not counting Sundays. So if you're trying to count and you're thinking, no, it's more than 40 days. It doesn't count Sundays, technically. But basically, Lent is a time for us to get honest with ourselves and allow God to tether out the junk that's within us, you know? And so to say to God, God, I'm ready for you to transform me again this year. It's a time for us to practice spiritual practices that can draw us close to God and that leave room for God to speak and move in our lives. Things like prayer and fasting, things like scripture reading and investing in a small group. So we do these things, and I want to invite you. We're launching something new that we have not done before. We're actually launching a 40 days of prayer journey that I want to invite you to be part of. 40 days of prayer journey. And we're going to start tomorrow. I want to encourage you to pray every day for 40 days. And so we actually have a guide in your program. If you want to take that out and look at it, there's a really easy guide that you can follow on the YouVersion Bible app. And basically on the devotion, at the end of it, there's really easy things that it tells you, pray for this today. So if you've ever thought, I don't know what to pray, it tells you how to pray and what to do. So I hope you'll follow along with us. It'll be 40 days starting Monday, and then we're going to go every day all the way through through Good Friday. So I hope you'll join us on that journey. But during Lent, we basically say, God, I'm ready for you to bring resurrection in me. So with all that said, today we're starting a brand new series called Road to the Cross. Road to the Cross. And it's interesting. Jesus lived on this earth for 33 years. But out of all the 33 years, most of the Gospels, if you were to read the Gospels, a good chunk of the Gospels is devoted to what happened in a period of 24 hours. That 24 hours leading up to the cross. And so in this series, we're going to take that road to the cross, that 24 hours that led up to that moment that changed the world. And so we're going to start in the upper room on Thursday evening and go all the way through Friday evening where Jesus died on the cross. And I think you're going to see, I hope you'll see, is that the cross was all about God's love for people and what God was willing to do to reach out and to save us from ourselves and to save us in our lives. And so here, let's begin the journey in Thursday evening at the Last Supper. Let's check it out, Mark chapter 14, starting with verse 12. It says this. It says, on the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" So he sent two of his disciples, telling them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. Say to the owner of the house he enters that the teacher asks, 'Where is my guest room, where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' He will show you a large room upstairs," sometimes it's called the upper room, "furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there." The disciples left, went into the city, and found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. So this is the setup for what we're going to talk about at the Last Supper. But you got to know that the disciples had basically spent all day at the Mount of Olives, which is a low mountain range. Everybody was there except for two people. Other scriptures tell us the two were John and Peter. And John and Peter were asked to go and prepare the Passover meal. But I want you to notice, as Jesus sends them out and says, "Hey, go prepare the meal," he kind of gives them redneck directions. You know what redneck directions are? I mean, this is what Jesus does. He gives them redneck directions. Redneck directions is like this. When you go into a small town or some place that you've never been, and you roll down the window, not like this, because we just go, you know, and it comes down. But you say to some, "Hey, buddy, can you tell me how to get here?" And he says, "Yeah. Well, what you need to do is you get to the man with the standing by the green mailbox holding a Piggly Wiggly cooler, and when you get there, take a left," right? That's redneck directions, right? And that's what Jesus does to him. He redneck directions him. He's like, "Hey, guys, follow, you know, find the man with a water basin and follow him." And they're like, "What?" Now, in this culture, men didn't really carry water basins, so this would have been a clear sign, but it's pretty cool. Jesus, how do you know that there's going to be a guy carrying a water basin? And, you know, it's like, well, he's God, right? He orchestrates things like this. And he says, and he'll lead you to a house where you're going to find the upper room. And sure enough, they do it, and there it was, just as Jesus had told them. And here's what I love about this. I love, first of all, that Jesus can put things exactly in its place so that he can lead them to where he wanted them to be. Same for us, right? The other thing I love about this is it just shows the details that Jesus orchestrated, the time that he spent, because he wanted to meet them in a secret place so that he could be alone one last time for one last supper with his 12 disciples. Today we call the scene that happened in the upper room, we call it sometimes Holy Communion. Sometimes we call it the Last Supper. But I want you to see today that what happened at the table was even more significant than even what we sometimes realize when we come to the table. Because it was connected, this Last Supper was connected to the Passover festival, the Passover feast that Jesus, that basically everybody celebrated every year. In fact, everyone in Jerusalem, if you were Jewish, you would have everybody would have been preparing for the Passover meal or the Passover Seder. Basically, it's kind of like it happened every year. It's a meal. I guess you could say it's kind of like Thanksgiving, because like every Thanksgiving we're going to eat a meal. But it was a holy meal. It was a different kind of meal where everybody would gather and you would eat certain things in the meal. It's very scripted so that you could basically rehearse and retell the story of how God freed his people in the book of Exodus. You may remember that story. It's the most important event in the Old Testament. Let's go back there so we can understand what the table really is about. You may remember in the book of Exodus that God God had already told his people before that I want to make you into a great nation, and I'm going to bless you so you can be a blessing to every nation in the world. And I'm setting you apart, and I'm gonna make you a nation, and I'm gonna send you into a land of your own. And they're like, "This sounds great." Well, God's people were stuck in slavery for 400 years. And I don't know if you've ever been in a place before where it's like you feel like there's the blessings of God and the call of God, and all of a sudden all you can see in front of you is nothing but being stuck. You ever been there before? We're just stuck in a waiting room. That's how God's people were. They were stuck by the hand of the oppressive ruler Pharaoh, being forced to work and forced to do things, being treated poorly. And God comes to a man who was a stutterer named Moses. And God says, Moses, I want you to go and I want you to communicate to the most powerful ruler in the land, Pharaoh. And I want you to say to Pharaoh, God says, let my people go. And so, this is crazy because it just shows Moses is a stutterer. He's being asked to communicate to the most powerful person. And in that moment, he's probably thinking, God, I can't. I can't do something like that, you know? And it's one of those things, if you've ever been called by God to do something, it's just a reminder that it's never about your own power. That if God has called you to it, he'll make a way to come through in your life. And so he goes to Pharaoh and he obeys God and he says, all right, Pharaoh, God says, let my people go. And Pharaoh said, no. And this is that moment when you followed after what God wants and it doesn't happen. I mean, it's this moment where Moses kind of goes back to God. And he's like, well, he said no, so I guess I'm done. Like, I guess that's all. And he's like, no, go back to him again. He goes back and back and back. And every time Pharaoh said no. And so God decided to bring a series of miracles. Started with 10 plagues. The last plague ended up being to strike down every firstborn child in Egypt because Pharaoh would not let God's people go. And it's one of those things where God says, here's what I want you to do. I want to save my people. And so this will be a sign. I want you to slaughter a lamb and paint the blood of the lamb over the door frame of your houses. I want you to do that. And this will be a sign that when the angel of death comes by and everybody's firstborn child dies, this will be a sign for that to pass over you so that you will be saved. And so they did. And they cooked the lamb and they ate it. And this is why when people celebrate the Passover feast today, they eat lamb. This is part of what happens. But they cooked lamb and they ate it as that their last supper before God freed them from slavery. The other thing that happened is they had to leave so quickly. They had to leave so soon in such haste that they didn't have time to bake bread. And so they basically ate unleavened bread, which is basically bread without yeast. And so now in the Passover feast, you eat unleavened bread that was cooked without yeast. And so all Jewish people would be gathered to celebrate how God saved them, how God rescued them, and how how death had passed over their houses by the blood of the Lamb. And eventually, how God parted the Red Sea and brought them to their freedom. I mean, that's their story. That's what they're celebrating. God has literally saved us from death, and he's freed us. He's freed us from bondage. And so here Jesus is. It's the Last Supper, right? It's the Passover festival. And Jesus gathers his disciples for that same meal, but this time, it's his Last Supper. And before he goes to the cross, and Jesus is about to connect what happened in the Passover festival, what happened back in the Exodus, where God freed and saved his people, Jesus is about to say, I want you to see that I'm about to free and I'm about to save people because of what I'm about to do on the cross. Now, I think that when you picture the Last Supper, I would imagine that most of us picture the Last Supper looking like the famous painting, Leonardo da Vinci, right? Here's a picture of it. This is the painting of the Last Supper, Leonardo da Vinci. And there's a lot of different versions out there. This is a picture of the original. And basically, you see Jesus sitting in the middle, and you see his disciples all around talking and communicating. This is a really nice painting, and it's accurate to some degree. But there are some things that Leonardo da Vinci didn't get right. One of the things is they didn't sit at chairs when they would sit at a table back then. What they would do is they would actually recline. You're going to see in a minute, they reclined at the table. They would recline, they would lean on their left arm, and they would eat with their right hand. Kind of sounds uncomfortable, doesn't it? It's like P90X or some crazy workout, you know, as you're eating, right? And so that's how they would eat. And this is also why in the scriptures, when there's a woman who is weeping over Jesus's feet, how could she do that if they were sitting at a table, right? This is why Jesus is like this, and she's weeping over his feet. See that? The other thing that's a little different than in this picture is that the table that they sat at was not a normal rectangular table. It was actually a Roman triclinium, probably. And here's a picture of a Roman triclinium. Tri meaning three. had three sides, and it's shaped like a U. And basically what would happen is everybody would eat along the outside, and servants and other people could eat or could come serve in the middle. So everybody's sitting around the outside. And I want you to notice this. In a triclinium, Jesus wouldn't have been in the center. The host of the meal would have been sitting at the second seat from the left. So you see Jesus right there. We also learn that John, he would have been the guest of honor, sitting to his right. And the one who counted the money and stuff like that would have sat to the left. Who do you think that was? Judas. So Judas is sitting there. And on the other side, across from him, kind of cross diagonal, was seen as another guest of honor. And that would have been probably Peter. And so we see here what's so fascinating in this story is we literally see that who's sitting in the places of honor. Judas, who would betray him, and Peter, who would deny him, right? And they're sitting in these places of honor at the table. And so finally, after sundown, the disciples gathered to share the Passover meal. And I want you to check out, here's what it says, Mark 14, verse 17. It says, when evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12. While they were reclining at the table, you see that? He said to them, truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. They were saddened, and one by one they said to him, surely you don't mean me. It is one of the 12, he replied, one who dips bread into the bowl with me. Now this is interesting because things had already been tense. Jesus had been, he just turned over the tables in the temple, and so people were real mad, right? Religious folks were not happy with Jesus. He turned over the tables in the temple. You know, whenever somebody says, well, what would Jesus do? You can always tell them, well, turning over tables is certainly an option, right? He turned over the tables in the temples because people were selling things in the temple, and they weren't coming to worship. It was preventing people from worshiping because they were turning it into a market. And so the other reason it was tense is because Jesus had been talking about his death. He said, hey, I'm gonna die, and after 3 days, I'm going to come back. And they were like, I don't know what that means, but I think you mean figuratively, right, Jesus? Like, you're going to go away for a little bit, and then you come back to our town. But he kept telling them over and over that I'm going to die, and I'm going to come back. But in the middle of all this, they're eating at the table. I don't know if you've ever been to a family gathering before, where, you know, there's some kind of drama or tension that's already going on in the family, and all of a sudden, pass the gravy, right, and then somebody blurts out the thing that offends everybody, right? This is basically what happens. Hey, everybody, let's have a meal together. Hey, one of you is going to betray me, right? Wow, that escalated quickly, right? One of you is going to betray me. And, you know, the disciples, they'd walked with Jesus for 3 years, and they loved Jesus. And they all looked around the room thinking, none of these guys would, like, after all that Jesus had done in all of our lives, who would turn their back on Jesus? Surely it's not me. Surely it's not me, right? It's interesting because in Mark's gospel, Matthew's gospel names that Judas is the one that will betray him. But in Mark's gospel, Jesus doesn't name the person. He just says it's one of the 12. The truth is, it was all the 12. Every single person turned away from Jesus. They all probably looked around realizing that Jesus had loved them so much. Like, who would betray Jesus, right? Well, Judas had already betrayed him. He'd already turned him in for money, and he'd already arranged for Jesus to be arrested shortly after. But the truth is, it's not just Judas. It was all of them. Judas betrayed him. Peter denied him 3 times. Every one of the disciples were hiding and leaving Jesus alone in the hands of his enemies. But I think Mark doesn't name a person's name because Mark is trying to put us in the scene at the Last Supper. He's trying to help you and me to imagine ourselves reclining at the table with Jesus, sitting there, feeling and experiencing his love. And all of a sudden, Jesus looks at us and he says, one of you will betray me. And we look at Jesus like, Jesus, after all that you've done in my life, like, surely not me. Like, I'd never be in a place like that in my life. But the truth is, all of us have. Like, all of us have sold ourselves out for other things. Instead of following Jesus, we've sold ourselves over to other things and other pleasures and other things that we run after to find life. All of us have, even unintentionally, fallen short of the glory of God. All of us have been in a place where we've fallen into sin patterns or even turned our back on Jesus in our lives. And so Jesus knew every sin in all the disciples, and he knows every sin and failure in us. He knew that we all would fall short and turn away. And in that moment, Jesus does something incredible. Here's what he does. Mark 14, verse 22. It says, while they were eating, Jesus took the bread. Let me play this out for you. Get some soap in my hands first. While they were eating, Jesus took the bread. And he gave thanks. When he gave thanks, he broke it. And he gave it to his disciples, saying, take it. This is my body. Here's what he says next. It says, then he took the cup. And when he had given thanks to the Father, basically, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. And here's what he says. He says, this is my blood of the covenant, basically of the new covenant, which is poured out for many, he said to them. And so he's offering all of this to them. What is Jesus doing? He realizes all of their failures, all of their shortcomings. And what does he do? There at the table, Jesus reaches out to people like you and me to offer so much more than bread and juice. What's he doing? He's offering his grace. He offered it to Judas, who knowing that he would betray him. He offered it to Peter, knowing he would deny him. And he offers it to us. Not just communion, but he offers his grace. In fact, it brings us to this big idea for today. The big idea is this, is that even your greatest sin doesn't disqualify you from God's grace. Even your greatest sin doesn't disqualify you from God's grace. As a pastor, sometimes, it's funny, when people find out you're a pastor, they either like stop cussing or talk differently, right? Or they start confessing everything that they've ever done in their life. Almost like an anti-resume. Right? Like, they're like, oh, I'm a preacher. And like, oh, well, I got to tell you what I did the other day. And like, oh, please don't. Right? And they start telling you this crazy stuff. And they're trying to show, if you only knew what I've done in my life, if you only knew where I've been and what I've done, you would know that Jesus could never love somebody like me. And this scene, though, reminds us that God's grace and his favor is for you. It's even you. Not because you've done anything to earn it. It's not being, and he offers it in spite of anything you could ever do to throw it away, right? It's one of those things where Jesus reaches out his hand of grace that loves you just as you are. But here's the kicker. His grace, he loves you so much that he doesn't allow you to stay where you are. He wants you to be transformed. It's this grace that can change your story. And at every Passover feast, the head of the meal, they would lift up bread. Every Passover meal, they lift up the bread and they would say this, this is the bread of affliction which our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Let everyone who hungers come and eat. Let everyone who is needy come and eat the Passover meal. But what does Jesus do? He changes the words. They're expecting to hear that, and then Jesus lifts up the bread and he says, this is my body which is given for you. This is my body. That's interesting because a few hours later, Jesus' body is about to be bruised and crushed and beaten and nailed to a cross. And thinking of you and thinking of me, Jesus stood in our place and offered his body just like that Passover lamb that was slain to free God's people from their sins. Jesus then lifts up the cup and he says, this is my blood. Now, this is the same cup in the Passover reading where basically it symbolizes the blood that was of the lamb that was sprinkled over the door so that God's people could be saved from death. And so Jesus is saying, hello, guys, this is my blood. In other words, I'm the lamb. I'm the lamb. I'm the lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, who was sacrificed to set you free from the slavery of sin and death. And so every time we come to this table of communion, even today, it's personal. Every time we come to the table, it's like a new Passover feast for us where we remember the sacrifice Jesus made for all of us. We remember the grace that we don't deserve and yet has been freely given for us. And at communion, he says, this is my body and this is my blood. But we're not literally eating Jesus' body and drinking Jesus' blood. But we're rehearsing and participating and what it means for Jesus to work in us. It's the bread and juice is an outward symbol of a real grace that Jesus does, works in our lives to change our lives. But that transforming grace isn't forced on us. Notice he says, take it and eat it. Take it, which means that we have to open our hands to receive it. That's why when you take communion here, we invite you to either come forward or to be served, because it's something, as you're served and as you reach out your hand, it's a way to say, yes, Jesus, I need your grace. And so every single time we come to the table, it's more than just a symbol, though. Every time we come to the table, Jesus is really present here. He's present, offering his grace to you. And so Jesus offers, invites to his table all who love him, who earnestly repent of their sins, for anyone who seeks to be at peace with God and with one another. The table of grace is for you. And so as we come to the table to take communion, may you know that the body of Christ has been offered for you. The blood of Jesus has been given for you.